Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, still working on... Hi. Okay, so note to self, remember the Blog Talk Radio welcome introduction and the music introduction. And then you could say hello. So hello and welcome to Perinatal Ponderings with Winona. As I wander and wander through the perinatal year, talking about all things related to pregnancy, birth, postpartum, mothering is what we're discussing today, and just exploring and learning and thinking together. So a little bit about me, of course, is I am a perinatal support specialist in that I provide birth, pregnancy, postpartum education, and parenting education to parents, and birth support for families, postpartum support, and lactation consultations for families. So really covering everything in that first year postpartum, or the fourth trimester as it's often called, and beyond with parenting. I've been a parent, I've been a mother now for almost 32 years and have learned a lot. The things you don't know you're going to learn when you first become a mother. And today's guest, if she is able to make it, we are working on figuring out the technical side of it, it's just episode 3. So I'm giving myself some leeway in that direction. So most of our episodes will be about an hour long. I'm sure that I could talk for more than an hour. In fact, I do quite often talk for more than an hour in classes and visiting with clients and having tea. It will also often be a long talk. So what we're going to do in this episode is really focus or think about or discuss the topic of mothering and being a mother and what's that mean? What happens when, you know, how do you become a mother? And all the different aspects around that. So as women, that's kind of the direction many of us take. And today is not a debate about choosing not to be a mother. That's fine. Or maybe not even, you know, having that choice made for you. That's fine. You're still a woman. We still all have mothers. That's a good place to start. There's many books I've read over the years about mothers in different cultures. Sometimes we think that everyone has this same experience in that we have in our Western culture in North America. But that, of course, isn't true, I guess. I've read some really sad and interesting books about mothers in Asia, about indigenous mothers. And I could probably list quite a few where it talks about their experience. And I think that's really important to think about. Not a lot, of course, has been written over the generations about our lived experiences as women and mothers. Kind of the everyday stuff. There's definitely bits and pieces everywhere. And, you know, I even go back to kind of my favorite topic, not topic, my kind of favorite story about the midwives in Egypt and how they stood up to Pharaoh and how the mothers, they said the mothers are so robust, they just have those babies before we get there. But also the mother's experience, Moses' mother's experience, and keeping him for as long as possible, and then ending up being his, what the princess thought was just a wet nurse when she was actually his mother. And so mothers are featured. You'll see throughout cultures, statues of mothers or statues of women, drawings. And so it's nothing new is what I'm trying to tell you. Becoming mothers is not a new thing. And of course, we wouldn't be here if we didn't have mothers. And with Mother's Day coming up, people start thinking about that, what their relationship is with their mother or what it means to them and what we expect as mothers. So just rambling. So we're going to do a reading from Ina May Gaskin, one of her books, Birth Matters. And of course, she kind of brought to light a lot of birth matters. And her story is interesting. And she, you know, is one of our elder midwives and women who maybe brought us back, especially during the feminist movement. And that, of course, is a whole other topic, what that means and what that's done. And then we're going to talk a little bit about some research that, again, Hensi Goyer has looked into, kind of what are the actual numbers for different things. And we're going to have a little song clip to listen to. Hopefully that works. And our herb of the day is red raspberry leaf. So we're going to read some of Susan Weed's good information on that. So I'm going to just start with reading from Birth Matters, chat a bit about that. If my guest makes an appearance, we're going to talk about our own experiences. Like I said, what was that becoming a mother like for the very first time? And what our experiences were and how kind of we felt we were viewed. And we come from a couple, you know, maybe a decade or so apart. So my earlier experiences might be a little different. And it doesn't start with when you get pregnant, of course. I remember very much in junior high when the big thing was the super mom, right? Like you can do it all. You can have a career and you can have kids and it'll all be good as long as you wear shoulder pads. That was kind of the thing because shoulder pads make you look big and tough like the men. And so being a mother was not seen as something important to do, but just something that you did. But your main goal was to have a career and change the world that way. And so for those of us who made the choice or were blessed to be able to stay at home and work from home and do things that was a priority for our family. And what did that look like? How did we feel? You know, I often felt kind of that little bit of guilt of maybe I should be working outside the home, right? Like the kids are fine. They'll grow up somehow. So some different thoughts on that. All right, so I'm going to read a bit from Birth Matters. And let's start with this. A little bit about the philosophy of the natural birth movement. And this is from Ina May Gaskin, Birth Matters. The natural birth philosophy that had its origins in the 1950s and 60s in the U.S. and continues today in many countries around the world is based upon a fundamental respect for nature that recognizes that nature mostly gets it right in birth. According to this philosophy, I'm actually more inclined to say observation, pregnancy is not an illness in need of treatment, and nature's design of women is not considered flawed. The late Professor G.J. Klosterman, an influential and eloquent Dutch obstetrician, perhaps said it best when he wrote, "By no means have we been able to improve spontaneous labor in healthy women. Spontaneous and normal labor is a process marked by a series of events so perfectly attuned to one another that any interference only deflects them from their optimum course." Such a philosophy, of course, does not recognize that a pathology or dangerous complication can occasionally develop even in healthy women, and that the application of a powerful technology, surgery for example, can be life-saving in these instances. However, it excludes the introduction of powerful technologies either preventively or preemptively. The guiding principles of the Coalition for Improvement of Maternity Service explain the natural birth philosophy quite well. Normalcy. Treat birth as a natural, healthy process. Empowerment. Provide the birthing woman and her family with supportive, sensitive, and respectful care. Autonomy. Enable women to make decisions based on accurate information and provide access to the full range of options for their care. Do no harm. Avoid the routine use of tests, procedures, drugs, and restrictions. Responsibility. Give evidence-based care used solely for the needs and in the interests of mothers and infants. Another set of principles related to natural birth was drawn up at the International Conferences on Humanization of Childbirth held in Fortaleza, Brazil in 2000. These principles fill out a vision of a better way for babies to be born. Humanized birth means putting the woman giving birth in the center and in control so that she, not the doctors or anyone else, makes all the decisions about what will happen. Humanized birth means understanding that the focus of maternity services is community-based, out-of-hospital primary care, not hospital-based tertiary or specialist care. Humanized birth means midwives, nurses, and doctors all working together in harmony as equals. Humanized birth means maternity services that are based on sound scientific evidence, including evidence-based use of technology and drugs. Women who share the natural birth philosophy want the opportunity to labor in a way that emphasizes human connection rather than monitoring by a machine. They know that surgeons and medical technology are necessary sometimes, but not infallible. And that, given the realities of human greed, ambition, impatience, institutionalized ignorance, and gullibility, it makes sense to trust the process of one's healthy body over the promises of miraculous cures and remedies, no matter how respected and authoritative the source may apparently be. As the late researcher and writer Barbara Seaman put it, some women want to let their doctors do the worrying for them, but for those of us who don't, it has been extremely difficult to get honest health information. So, a long time ago, natural birth, the natural birth movement, or back to birth movement, was really focused on humanizing birth, making women the center of the decision makers. and the decision makers. And that still is the case. But it's very hard now to use the term natural because it's been so corrupted. But that is a story for another day. So that's something to think about, that through the 60s, the 50s, the 60s, the 70s, the 80s, the 90s, the 2000s, women trying to be seen and heard when it comes to birth. And yes, things have changed. And yes, we have seen improvements in some ways, in other ways, not so much. And our experiences are different. Every person has a different experience of things. So that is from Ina May, and I'm going to read one more passage from her to kind of help us get the discussion going. Excuse me. I know you don't want silence when you're doing a radio show. Okay. So here's another discussion to get going. And man, you could have a discussion just about technology and birth. You could have a discussion just about women moving to birth in the hospitals, or what happened, like how did the natural birth movement start? Who started it? And I think in that case, it was women from around the world. It wasn't just in one particular spot. Yeah. So, and this one, this kind of little talk from Ina May, talks about the second wave feminism, birth, and motherhood. So that, like I said, feminism, we could talk about that another day. But I'm just going to read a little passage from here. The sacred feminine is very closely related to women's ability to give birth. This has been true throughout human existence. Archaeological finds, such as the Venus of Willendorf of Austria, the Venus of Lespuge of France, the Sheila na Gigs of the Irish and British Isles, the pregnant goddess figures of Central Europe, and the birth figures of Latin America, among others, confirm that the creative power of the birth-giving woman has given honor and respect in cultures in diverse parts of the world. It is interesting that the second wave feminism, as expressed in the U.S. during the 60s and 70s, was largely scornful of the status of women of indigenous cultures and assumed not only that all women in such cultures were victims of patriarchal systems, but also that there was no expression of female power within them. The general view was that women who lived without access to modern technology had little or no, real power. Some influential feminist voices that were otherwise quite insightful almost exclusively saw motherhood as a trap to women's advancements, one that should be avoided by whatever means possible. References to babies as parasites and phrases such as baby pollution were commonly heard, and anyone who advocated for more natural ways of giving birth than was norm in the 70s was considered by many to be a traitor of her gender. I learned this for myself on a memorable occasion. Asked to speak briefly about my work in midwifery to an auditorium of Yale students in the mid-70s, I showed a couple of slides of mothers and their newly born babies from my community and was surprised as they immediately and vehemently chorus of boos and hisses that came from the young women present. Instead of seeing midwifery as a means of female empowerment, these young feminists were repulsed by the very idea of birth. If anyone in that audience had the slightest curiosity regarding that subject, the auditorium was not a safe place to express a question. For this group of young women, who were, as far as I could tell, pretty representative of the philosophy that was prevalent on college campuses at the time, the only worthwhile choice was to avoid motherhood by any means necessary. Really interesting. So these are things I remember because I grew up, okay, going to date myself a little bit. I grew up in the 70s, or yeah, I guess, yeah, I did, in the 70s and 80s and had children in the 90s. So this wave, as she says, of feminism that happened in the 60s and 70s, and even before that, the women's suffrage movement, right? Like things don't just all of a sudden appear. There's kind of an accumulation of events or of thoughts that happen. But a lot of times, the women that were seen as these proper stay-at-home moms, and there was all this, you would read in magazines like how to have a happy husband, how to clean your home, how to get your meals on the table and take care of your children, that was seen as oppressive to a lot of women. And, you know, we can't totally bash men all the time either, because it was these women during this period who wanted the gas for during birth, who didn't feel that they should feel any kind of pain or unpleasant sensation because they wanted to be equal with men. And so ourselves, our own people, our women, were kind of the ones that pushed for that. And so it's been interesting living through kind of the tail end of that 60s and the 70s as women were now moving more into the workforce. And of course, going back, that all kind of started with, you know, during the war, and women had to go work in factories and could wear pants, all that kind of stuff. And so going through that, that's kind of, you know, what I heard in the background. My mom was a nurse. She had a career. I was one of those latchkey kids of the 80s, my brother and I, and other things. You know, I had community people, my grandparents also. But like I said, I just remember very much hearing that, you know, if you want to be just a mom, like that's nothing. Like, why would you want to do that? And so that's kind of been suppressed over the years. But I feel like it's coming back. Women are, we got the sourdough craze, right? Women want to kind of work on mothering. They want to homeschool. They want to teach their own children. They want to be there for their children. They want to provide healthy meals, as well as so many. I mean, the majority of businesses and things that come from the home are women who want to stay home and work. And so trying to find means to help support their family also. And then we have also a whole range, right? We have the single moms, and we have blended families and all sorts of different scenarios. But whatever scenario you're in, you're a mom or you've birthed. And I know that all mothers didn't birth their children in their womb, but in their heart. But I just think about that. I think about the evil, wicked stepmother scenario that we've seen, you know, in Disney movies, all sorts of movies. We've seen how the old wise woman is kind of featured as this old hag. And so there's a lot of different ways that, mothers have been viewed not in a pleasant light, so to speak. I kind of see that trend now with fathers. where they're portrayed as ignorant, as backwards, as bumbling, right? Like, it always seems to be, can we just have like two people who have children who are very pleasant and do good things? Can we have that? That would be nice. So I'm going to share a little bit about my story, kind of, you know, not in depth or anything, but just my thoughts and experiences as not only becoming a mother, but taking care of other people's children, doing childcare, and kind of their experiences of having to work working and, you know, taking care of their kids. And I always thought, wow, that's a lot, right? To have to go to work plus do all the other things and take care of kids and make arrangements and make sure there's food on the table, all that kind of stuff. I've read a lot of books about home management, how to manage your home and your children and try and stay on top of things. It's a big job. And then we've had kids in our home who have come from situations that their mother was unable or unwilling to care for them, and kind of the impacts on those kids. So a lot of this has to do with what are the kids getting out of this, right? How are they feeling about the world? What information are they getting about parenting, about mothering? What are the little girls getting about what it means to be a mother? Do our little girls want to do that? And I think we see that in the decline of our birth rates, right? Especially over the last few years, again, different topic, but we are seeing declining birth rates in our culture, in our Western culture. And in some cultures where that has been something going on for a very long time, where children are more limited, we're seeing the result of that now, where we have more boys in the population than girls because boys were more wanted. And so I think we're really seeing the results of that. And so there's lots to it. So my own experience coming from the 80s, child of the 80s, yes, I did have some clothes with the big shoulder pads and suits, right? Women wanted to wear pantsuits. But my kindergarten little write-up was I wanted to be a mom when I grew up. And I had some good examples around, you know, with my own mother and grandmother and different women in our community that I saw and really didn't think about how hard that would be. But that was what I wanted to do if I wasn't going to become a vet or a band teacher. That was my thing. And so I've had a few experiences, and of course, my first experience of being pregnant and becoming a mother, I was a teenager, older teenager, but still a teenager. Thought I was quite mature at the time. And I often compare kind of my experiences with what I see young moms going through now. My experience, of course, as a teen mom was like, oh no, like we don't want people to know, or even though you should maybe go away somewhere else, but it all worked out. And we had our first child, and as very young parents, we got a lot of advice, but I didn't have a lot of books or resources available to me. And of course, this was before the internet. Most of my, honestly, I'm going to be honest with you here, most of my references were from Louis L'Amour books because I was really into Louis L'Amour at the time. And he would write about, there wasn't a lot like of women and stuff. It was more, you know, more cowboys and the Wild West type things. But to me, I was like, yeah, like I'm going to be like a strong pioneer woman and do all that stuff. So I didn't, you know, we didn't take any prenatal classes, like nothing like that. But again, I grew up around animals and I saw, you know, how animals made babies and I saw how they birthed their babies. And I figured, hey, that's something that I could just do, just have a baby. I didn't have friends that were my age that were having babies. And so I kind of muddled through. And our first baby when we gave birth was quite the experience in that I didn't know, and which is why I teach this now, I didn't know you could say no. I didn't know you could say, hey, I don't want all these students in my room looking at me, which was very uncomfortable. And I remember shutting down and I didn't want to make a fuss or, you know, because comments were said about me being so young. And so I was pretty quiet throughout that birth process. Didn't want to say much, didn't want to ask for anything, didn't want to seem like I was out of control or anything. I wanted to be very in control. And thankfully, that birth just progressed as it should. And the doctor that I had at the time was very open to discussion about things I wanted and didn't want. About things I learned, and I would look things up and I would bring those to her and say, hey, I don't want any of this to happen. And she was very, very good and open with, oh yeah, that's fine. One thing that I noticed between having a child back then in the early 90s and having, supporting women now, things are pushed a lot more. So medications, inductions, cesareans, all those things have increased and are much more pushed, encouraged, talked about than they were when I had kids. Now, you have to remember that each hospital, each health region, each part of the country, everyone has had different experiences. It really is based on the culture in that community. And you have to think about, well, where does that come from? Where is that coming from? So with my first birth, of course, I was kind of on the tail end of keeping moms in the hospital for a week after they had baby. And during that week, baby was in the nursery, and then they would bring baby to you to feed. And I didn't really like that much. I remember where my room was and going to the nursery, which was kind of right across the hall from me, and sitting in there on the rocking chair. And the nurses were like, oh, you're supposed to be getting rest. And I'm like, I don't want to be apart from my baby. Not thinking, well, just take the baby to your room. I didn't know I was allowed. We felt that, like, we weren't in charge yet of these little guys. And so, yeah, I was in there for about 5 days, 5 or 6 days. Nothing wrong. I was fine. They would bring in meals. But they also helped with breastfeeding, substituting with formula wasn't common. Kind of in that 90s era. Although I do know in some places, speaking to other moms, it was still kind of pushed. Through the 60s, 50s, 60s, 70s, it was the thing. Everyone bottle fed, no one breastfed. And if you did, that was kind of weird. And through the 80s, we tried to get kind of back to breastfeeding. And you will see this throughout the centuries that there's often a back to nature type movement going on. And there was often, when it come to birth and breastfeeding, there was often, you know, how do we birth and breastfeed would be more natural, and then it would be more technical. And so this is a common thing for how women birth and feed their babies, for it to come and go. So so it was interesting. Sorry, just trying to get my guest on here. See if I can get her connected. Okay. Totally lost my train of thought. I'm just going to try one more time to get her a link. Okay. So sometimes I look back on that now compared to kind of when my fifth baby was born, which was a very different experience, and I was home before 24 hours because I had other kids to take care of. But sometimes I'm like, oh man, that was nice to have meals brought. They had the time to talk about breastfeeding, and they had time to show you. We had cloth diapers way back then in the hospitals. You know, show you how to diaper, show you how to bathe. It was very kind of relaxed. Also kind of smaller town. So maybe in the bigger centers, it was a bit different. The other thing was that I didn't know that there was still women in our province, midwives in our province, that were around and people giving birth at home. And it never occurred to me. I didn't even think about it. And, you know, maybe that's kind of the era or the community I was brought into, that no one talked about that end of it. And then when it came to breastfeeding also, there wasn't really any lactation consultants in the community. There wasn't, you know, I didn't see it, really. I didn't see it at all, especially women my age, young women breastfeeding. And I, of course, found out later that's usually because the women were in their house hiding while they were breastfeeding. And so I knew, of course, from seeing animals feed their young and from milking goats, that kind of figured out, well, how that's going to work. With my first run, I remembered that, well, people would tell me that I should pump some milk to have in the freezer. And we didn't have electric pumps or anything. We just had the hand. We had a little glass tube, and then it had a little plastic ball on the end. And that's how you would pump. And I had milk in my freezer. And I couldn't figure out why. Like, what was the thinking? And some of it was, well, if you get sick and have to go to the hospital, okay, or if, because you're young, you might want to go out on the weekends and party. Someone told me that. Well, you're still young. Don't you want to go out on the weekends? I'm like, oh, really? I'd like to just spend time with my baby, if that's okay with you. And so I had all this milk, and I remember at some point being, why do I have all this milk? And so I had a lot of milk. I leaked a lot because I was pumping. I was nursing my baby and then also pumping, and got quite uncomfortable with all that milk. Yeah, so it's kind of interesting what we do. just based on what we've heard, like, oh, well, someone said that to me, so I guess I should do it. And we don't even think about it as new moms because, of course, our brains are a little befuddled. And so, yeah, now I'm like, oh, man, all that breast milk went to waste. I could have used it. I could have done something with it. I dumped it. It just threw it away. Liquid gold, all gone. Thankfully now we have milk banks, and milk sharing is a big thing. And it used to be a big thing. It used to, when the Leche League started, kind of back in the 60s there, feeding each other's babies was what they did, right? If one mom, for whatever reason, couldn't feed, then we fed each other's babies. Or maybe, you know, mom had to run out somewhere and baby got hungry. Well, we just fed him. So lots of different things there in relation to then and now. And I'm sure if you talk to your mothers or your grandmothers about their experiences, it'll be very different. No one really has the same experience. But also ask them about how they felt about being a mother, right? You're having a baby, taking care of the baby, you're mothering the baby, you're nursing the baby, or not, right? What was the breastfeeding culture around, you know, when you were a baby? Were you breastfed? And it was definitely, now looking back, interesting because we were much younger than a lot of the other parents. And yeah, I think I did give my baby a bottle with breast milk, maybe formula, because I also got the idea that, she also needed that. So, you know, I always say, give yourself some leeway because you don't know what you don't know. You're just trying to do what's best for your baby or what you think is best, kind of based on what you've heard, what you've seen, what people have told you. Maybe sometimes you haven't even had that, and so you're just kind of doing it on the fly, which is pretty good, I think, that we can do that also. Oh, here we go. Okay. I am going to welcome my guest. Let's see if this works, Drina. Are you there?
Hello.
Oh, she's here.
Oh, it worked.
We figured it out.
Wow.
Okay, next time it'll be longer. How are you doing?
Mm-hmm. I'm good.
That's good. So Drina is a good friend. Although we've never met in person, we still need to do that. Meet in person.
Yes.
Yeah. But she's also a member of the 5 Kid Club, which is a good club to be part of. You could be a part of the 1 Kid Club or the 2 Kid Club, but it's always nice to find someone with 5. It's an odd number, so
it is.
We like it. Yeah. So just talking about my first, some of my thoughts about having my first baby. We could be here for a long time if we talked about each one, but what, when you think of all your different births, when you think of your very first experience, what were some of your, like, you don't have to go into detail, but just what did you think? Did you know anything or did you wing it?
I knew nothing. I didn't know anything, and I, you know, got the what to expect when you're expecting books and all those kind of things, which now I realize were helpful in the time, but there's so much more out there. But yeah, no, I had no idea. I was super excited and very happy and couldn't wait to experience pregnancy. And then when it came to the birth time, oh man, because that could be a whole episode in itself.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, I was not well informed as much as I would have liked to have been. Yep. Yeah. It was, I had all the things that I didn't have with my fifth birth.
Yeah.
So all the medicalization tools, methods, which left, I feel like it was like a traumatic birth.
Mm.
So not a good first birth in that sense.
Yeah. Were you in a bigger hospital or small town? Or?
Yes. Big hospital.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I wonder if that makes
and I was
a difference.
With
because they're busier.
I feel like it does because you're kind of getting moved along the conveyor belt, so to speak. You know, like a huge maternity ward. At that time, I feel like because I was in my own little bubble, there were so many births happening in the hospital. This was back in 2000. I feel like it does make a bit of a difference. I have birthed in a small town hospital as well, and there was a major difference.
And you were in a different decade than me. So I have my first one like a decade before, and I feel like there wasn't things done or pushed in the 90s, like they were starting in the 2000s.
Yeah, like I felt like I did not have, I was just at the mercy of the practitioner.
Yeah.
So I had a GP for my practitioner, my care person, and they had to call in an OB. And I had an epidural, so I had the anesthesiologist there. So I had all the people. And I felt like I was at their mercy. Like there was no choices being given to me. It was just done.
Yep.
Yeah.
Do you think that impacted your mothering? How you mothered?
Yes. Oh my gosh. Yes. Not so much mothering, but just the experience postpartum. So I guess in essence, yes, it does impact your mothering. Breastfeeding was very difficult. The first six, the first 9 weeks were, I almost gave up, even though I had the assistance of a public health nurse that came and tried to assist me. It wasn't a breastfeeding specialist. It was very, very difficult and very challenging immediate postpartum period. But then once things settled and once I got the hang of breastfeeding, it was more joyous. It was wonderful.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's like telling mothers, don't quit on your worst day.
Right? Yeah. Oh my goodness.
Keep going.
We got all the little gadgets and all the things to help with the breastfeeding. And I was so determined. I was like, I am doing this.
Yeah. And were the people around you encouraging for breastfeeding?
Yes, they were.
Yeah.
But they did say, you know, there is the option of bottle feeding. You know, your baby needs to be fed, you know, blah, blah, blah. And I still persevered. I did not bottle feed any of my babies.
Nice. Yeah, like I was just thinking back to my first. I think I gave her a bottle. I think I have a picture. So my husband's like, yeah, you did give her a bottle at some, like not early on, but at some point. Because
I thought that's what you did.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I didn't realize that they never have to have a bottle.
Like, either.
I just
it was
kind
so
of assumed.
Normal. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's just normal. Like it was just presented as this is a normal alternative.
Yeah. And there was, there were such cute shapes. Like I remember one bottle was like the shape of a 7-Up bottle or something. Like, now I'm like, oh, all the plastics and that.
Wow.
But yeah. And you just assumed you had to give formula also.
Yeah.
But,
yes.
You know, and no one told me any different. Yeah.
Me too. I think I tried it once when we were transitioning from breastfeeding to weaning off. And it was, like, I was even grossed out by it. Just I mean, back then it was really, not really weird. And even my son wouldn't take it.
Yeah.
So that was telling.
Yeah. And I mean, the worst part for me was washing bottles because we didn't have a dishwasher or anything. And that was so tedious to wash bottles.
Yeah, it's so much more convenient and easy to breastfeed.
Yeah. I think part of that is we were a population that was much closer to farming. Either like you came from a farm with animals or you had a grandma with a farm or, right? So you kind of saw that with the animals that, they can, you know, like I was saying, I milk the goats all the time. So I kind of had an idea of how that all worked. So.
You're lucky. I did not grow up on a farm, but I was around farms a lot.
Yeah. I think the more we get away and we have more generations getting away from that and seeing that it might be a little harder to figure out or to hang in there, right? Like you can do it.
Yeah, I was definitely determined. I was not giving up, even though it was excruciatingly painful and I had to use like devices to help breastfeed. It was it was not ideal, but considering the mindset that I was in after the birth experience, I'm actually quite surprised that I persevered.
But that might be why you did. Right.
True.
Like,
yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I felt like there was like a bit of a, sorry, go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
I was just going to say there was a bit of a disconnect right after the birth because, meaning like I wasn't immediately connected with my son because there was a hemorrhage issue where the OB came in and had to deal with it. And so it was my husband at the time that was holding our son. So I feel like that, even though it was probably, I don't know, anywhere between 1 minute to 10 minutes of the of a disconnect there, that had a huge impact, I feel, on the breastfeeding relationship.
Yeah, I mean, it is nice that they do try and keep, you know, baby skin to skin. in the hospital now. They're working on the importance of that time immediately after birth, if possible. They still have ways to go to work on that, but lots of separation. But yeah, like when I had my first, it was take baby. Oh, look, you have a baby. Actually, with my first one, they handed baby to my husband, and he left the room because he wanted to go show the baby to my mom and grandma in the hallway. And the nurse was going after him, wait, you can't take the baby out. He's like, oh, it's my baby. I'm going to show people. But yeah, they took baby and they weighed her and measured her, and they made me get up right away to have a shower.
Oh, wow.
And then get dressed, and then they got the baby bundled, and so it seemed like, you know, probably at least 10, 15 minutes or longer, maybe 20 minutes before I got to hold her, and it was all bundled up, and then they take them to the nursery. So different way, but still that disconnect. You know, that you get immediately when you can smell them and, you know, kiss them and all those things, you know. Now that's nice, right? To be skin to skin. Really important.
Yeah. So in the 2000s, when he was born, I was able to have him in my room. There was no nursery at this hospital. But when I had my daughter, my second child, it was in a smaller town, and they didn't have a nursery, but they took her so that I could rest. And I was so oblivious, and I woke up. I was like, okay, I'm only going to shut my eyes for a few minutes, I thought. And then I woke up, and I couldn't find my baby, and I was like walking in the hallway going, hello?
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh, she's in the nursery. I'm like, well, what has she been eating? So I, So that was another traumatizing birth.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and they still do that. They'll be like, if it's at nighttime, you know, oh, well, just hold your baby so you can rest, right?
Yeah, that's so foreign to me now.
Yeah. The babies and moms get more rest when they're together.
Exactly.
Things happen better when they're together.
And things regulate.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I could talk about my birth stories over like 5 episodes.
Right?
One
or more.
Per birth. Yeah.
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 Yeah. And so with your fifth baby, so like with my fifth baby, my first one, I was teen mom, and with my fifth, I was considered geriatric, which is a whole other pet peeve. It's the worst word ever. And what did you notice difference between your age, right? You have some experience behind you. You're a little older. But still, what was the treatment like? Like, how are you viewed?
Well, I had a home birth for my fifth. And so night and day. And because I was about 39, I think, so still considered geriatric, considered a multi-para, which is having multiple births, more than one birth. And I was viewed as like an experienced birther, not an old person giving birth. So it was quite nice. It was a little more empowering, and just the whole experience from the moment I had first signs of the birth process to immediately after she was born, it was like you can't even compare.
Yeah,
it was just, it was miraculous, and it was amazing and beautiful, and I would do it over and over and over again until I couldn't no more.
Yeah. And so how did you feel that connection then, that in those first moments and first days with baby?
It was, this baby was with me the second after she exited my body. She was with me for like up until, like, she still sleeps with me. Oh, she's six. So like,
yeah,
that was like immediately I was noticing the difference in my recovery, in my postpartum recovery. It was, I don't even have words to explain the difference. I was not as tired. I was not as lethargic. I was not as disinterested. Breastfeeding was still difficult, but it was way easier by far. And then, consequently, they became easier. My breastfeeding experiences became easier with each child. Still difficult, though, but, like, it was 2 weeks instead of 9 weeks.
Right.
Huge differences.
Yeah.
And I was so much more aware. There was no interventions. There was no drugs. Interruptions with the environment. Like, it was just so flowing. It flowed so nicely. Even though I anticipated her birth being shorter, because every birth I had got shorter and shorter, and hers doubled. And I'm like, wait, what?
Yeah.
So that might have been the only interruption that I was not really welcoming, but whatever.
Yeah.
It was by far the best experience. Best birth experience I've had. And
awesome.
I'm so grateful that I was able to have a home birth.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And I only had, a traditional birth worker, a doula, my good friend who was taking photos and videos, and then my partner at the time was there.
Nice.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And it is hard. Like, how do you even compare that? Right?
You can't.
It's like apples
there's
and oranges.
There's too many things to talk about. Yeah, there's too many things to talk about and compare and dissect. And it just. But if you want to know more.
Don't have the time, Gina.
I know.
Do you think that you were... like, if you think about your perspective of yourself as a mother, do you think it was different after your first experience versus your fifth? Like, were you were more confident in yourself? You were, like, more determined
more
with...
confident. Yeah. And I just felt like I had a bit of ground under me as far as experience and knowledge.
Yeah.
And it just... found having more kids became easier.
Mm-hmm. It does.
Yeah. And people are like, how do you do? How do you have five kids? Like, oh my gosh, I can't even handle one.
Yeah. Well, one is hard. I think one is
hard
because, because you're it. Like, all your attention, your focus, your whatever is on the one child. Yeah, so I think that's hard too, and you're concerned, right? Like, they need to socialize, they need to go see. And you're maybe a bit more kind of alone feeling, right, with just one kid. Yeah.
Yes, and after my first, I was so inclined to just, quote unquote, get back on my feet, you know, like get out there. And, cause I think at that time, we only had 6 months for maternity leave. So I was like, oh man, I need to get out there. And, you know, but then with my fifth, I absolutely appreciated the downtime and I was not in a rush to get outside of my house. So it definitely brings different perspectives to the table.
perspective of time is different, right?
Oh my gosh.
The first kid, you're like, they should be talking. They're 2 months old. I should get them potty trained. They should be getting ready for university,
Right? And as more time moves on, and if you have more children after that, you have a different appreciation for time.
And
experiencing like all the little milestones that they have to go through. Differently.
I never had to worry about mat leave because I never really worked anywhere that I would have that, or I was always at home.
But I still found
with the fifth one, I was busier just because I had older kids, and I didn't take the time because I went straight from giving birth to running kids around and doing all the things, right? And to me, it's like, oh, the more kids you have, the more time you should really take.
It's so true.
You know, just heal too.
And the healing time affects breastfeeding. It affects your flow after birth, after birth flow. It's all connected. And I was just going to say with the maternity leave thing, I actually never went back to work. I couldn't. Couldn't do it. At 6 months, I could not hand my baby off. So I was fortunate that way. And I've never had to experience a maternity leave after that either.
Thankfully, I mean, in Canada, we do have that time. In the States, maybe if you're lucky, they get 6 weeks. So it's a much bigger topic down there. But I know moms that still feel like they need to get back to work after a couple months, right? As women, they're like, oh, I got this career and I need to get back to work. So, I mean, everyone's kind of different in that.
Exactly.
It's good to talk about, you know, it's okay to not want to go back to work. You could figure it out.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you're still working. You're still doing a job. You're still important things to get done.
Yeah. The role of mothering is a job.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And too bad you couldn't put all those things on your resume.
I do, actually.
Household manager. Yeah.
Today
I was a nurse.
Today I was a nurse. And then after that, I was a chef.
I have been planning
I think that's important.
For 30 plus years.
I'm going to need some pointers from you.
I've been feeding people for a long time.
And I love this job immensely.
It is. I think it's about perspective, too.
It is.
How do you feel about being
here?
Mother? That is why we're here. We have an important thing. That's awesome. Thank you for sharing those stories. And we're not neglecting the three in between. They were awesome.
No, we're not.
But
those are very different in themselves too. But all my experiences were so different.
Mine too.
Because
I mean, you're in a different place every time.
Yeah.
Like you've had life happen in between births. But, and
we
I thought like a, when a I, third... for the third baby, we should do a third baby show.
Those are interesting, aren't they?
Those are third babies. Yeah.
It's a myth. But there's some truth to that.
there's something there. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. No, we should do like a whole birth series.
Absolutely. Yeah, and going forward, I'm hoping to, I have like a list of people in my head I want to invite to be guests, but anyone, we figured out how to call in if anyone else has birth stories they would like to share. And just your experience, like how you felt. Sometimes when people share birth stories, it's very technical. Like
very.
I got induced and yeah.
Yes. And I think it's super important in the healing process and the postpartum process to go through that process of expressing how you were feeling and what you were feeling in those moments. Because, yeah, you're right. A lot of the times it is like all the technical stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. And part of that is we don't know maybe how we were feeling, or we weren't feeling seen or heard. And so we don't think that's an important thing. That.
I definitely felt like that in my first. Yeah.
Almost like you're not part of the process.
Exactly.
Yeah.
How is that?
I know it's kind of weird, but yeah.
Yeah.
Dissociation does that to you, right? So.
Oh my goodness. Yep. We were talking about that the other day.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, if people want to join in on the discussion, they're welcome to call in or let me know and I can send them links. And it'd be kind of neat to have a birth story section to the podcast.
Yeah. It's good to stand and hear other women's experiences because we feel like sometimes we're the only one, like we're all alone in this, but and it's just, it's so helpful, I feel, in the healing process too. Not that you have to heal from your birth, but, you know, some women do experience traumas and it's just, it's a good way to create community and like a sense of sisterhood.
Yeah. And even though each woman's experience is individual to them, there's a lot of common themes in those experiences. And when we hide them or don't talk about them, things won't change. Whatever needs to change. So
there's lots that needs to change.
Definitely.
Which is why we're talking.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What can we do in our little corner of the world to encourage women and to learn and to be okay with decisions they make? That's also an important
thing. Exactly. You have to feel confident in your decisions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And I think like with being a mom, that it's almost like a polarizing thing now because we went through the whole mommy wars things. I think maybe that's died out or maybe I'm just ignoring it now. I don't know. But, you know, like all the decisions and choices we make, we all think we're being judged by someone else about them.
So, yeah.
It's like, can we just share what we know and encourage each other?
Yeah, exactly. It even brings a sense of more peace when it's that way.
Yeah.
And not so much competition. It's definitely not a competition.
Right? Like, there's really no point in competing because there's always going to be someone who it looks like on the outside they're just, that person has like seven kids and they're so put together. It's like, why can't I do that?
Well, and each child is so different. Like, even in your own family, like, you cannot even compare your children. Like, it's just, they're all so very unique.
I said, I always thought I was a good mom with my first two. I'm like, oh, wow, I got myself together. I got all figured out. And then the third one came along. I'm like, oh, I guess I got things to
nothing.
Learn. Yeah. I didn't know children did that.
Well, and I had a huge gap in between my second and third. There was a 9-year gap. So it was like with my third, it was like I was starting all over again.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. But that's an interesting dynamic too.
Yeah. Yeah. I have 6 years gaps in there too. So.
Oh, wow.
Just when you think you're like, all right, maybe that can do other things, and then yeah, another one comes along.
Story of my
life.
We
can talk about planning one of these days too.
That doesn't really work.
I know. My husband doesn't believe me when I tell him that some women plan, some couples like plan when they're going to have babies.
I know. I mean, it is possible, definitely.
Sure.
There's like a science to it.
Yeah,
but
absolutely. But they still come when they're meant to be, they come. So,
and I love learning about that and sharing that because it's something that is definitely not touched on in our day.
Yeah, and especially with a lot of women who are having trouble. They're having trouble.
Mm-hmm.
They really want a baby. They're having trouble conceiving for whatever reason.
Mm-hmm.
So they're there's
oh my
that
gosh,
whole
there's
dynamic.
So much.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. I still got my cough.
For days. I hear that. Oh no.
We're getting
it
under control.
Did you take that Moulin tea?
Oh no, because I thought I had it, but it was I don't have that one. I have Slippery Elm, which is also good for sore throats and stuff. But it's allergy stuff, so working on that. I noticed a post about a 2-year-old with allergies, and they were wanting to give a lot of medications. And it was very tempting not to say, like, that's the road I went down, and now I'm trying to heal things without all the medications.
Yeah.
But, yeah, raspberry tincture, and there's lots of ways to deal with it.
Did you talk about that yet?
I haven't. I'm gonna,
Red
raspberry, but more related to earthy stuff. So
yeah.
I've got a few minutes left here.
Oh, dear. Okay, you take the reins then.
No, I want to hear the misconception now.
Oh, just that the people who sort of are on the fence about, you know, natural remedies or whatnot,
mm-hmm.
it's something to remember that it isn't a quick fix sometimes. It can take a bit longer, and that's just having that patience and that trust that, you know, you are actually creating the environment that your body needs to heal rather than just, you know, doing the opposite. So it does take some more time sometimes with the more, with the less conventional, more natural remedies.
Yeah. Well, and if you think about it, even if you take over-the-counter medications, it's the perception that they work quickly, but they don't often work quickly.
And then there's a whole host. And then there's a whole host of like, oh, what are these other symptoms? Where are they coming from?
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Because allergies start in the gut. So that's usually a good place to start, healing your gut.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. Learning all about that too.
Yeah. That will be another show also.
I know. We have so many shows coming up.
Yeah. Yeah. But yeah, I'll wrap that up because I'm going to have a couple more things to talk about, and then so I hope we make it on again, but we'll ask around. And of course I want to kind of focus on some Canadian wisdom here, some Canadian folks. So I have some people in mind to join me for that, and it's good to get a Canadian perspective, because a lot of what women hear or learn is US based stuff also. So.
Right, and it doesn't really apply here.
Yeah. Yeah. Or it's done a little differently too, so.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, thanks for joining me, Drina.
You're welcome.
We will be talking soon.
Talk again.
Yeah.
Yep.
Okay.
All right.
Bye for now.
All right. Okay. Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye. Okay, thank you for joining me. Then I don't feel like I'm talking to myself for a whole hour. All right, I want to play a song for you. We'll see if it works. Last time you couldn't hear the song, so hopefully you can hear it this time. And this is just a clip. It's not the full song, of course, but it's an a cappella song by Maria Mulder, Lord Save My Child, which is kind of her version of a Bob Dylan song, but I thought it was appropriate for talking about mothers.
For her age, she is wise. Lord, she's got a daddy's eye. There's gladness in her heart. She's young and she's wild. My only prayer is if I can't be there. Oh, Lord, protect my child. This whole earth is asleep. You can look at it and weep. Few things you find are worthwhile. Lord, you know I don't ask for much. No material things to touch. But oh, Lord, protect my child. She's young and on fire, full of hopes and desires, in a world that's been raped and defiled. If I fall along the way and can't make it another day, Lord, protect my child.
Okay, there, of course, go look that song up. It's very touching, that song. All right, a couple minutes left here. I just wanted to direct you towards some more research by Hensi Goyer. And on her page, hensigoyer.com, you will find a very lengthy and in-depth article on the research for how often does cesarean scars give way during VBAC, which is probably the biggest discussion that is had with women who want to have VBACs. And I'm not going to read the whole article. I'm just going to read the summary. It's, like I said, quite in-depth, lots of statistics in there. But this would be a good one to photocopy. Lots of women now wanting the VBAC because, of course, we have lots of cesareans happening. So a good information to look over and to discuss with your provider when you are deciding on VBAC. So the summary is, or the takeaway she has here for uterine scars giving way, uterine ruptures. The best outcomes will be achieved in labors that are uncomplicated by problems with the scar and that end in vaginal birth. That means that having care providers who are supportive of VBAC and skilled at managing VBAC labors will maximize your chances of an uneventful spontaneous vaginal birth. Having a VBAC protects against scar problems in subsequent labors. That means if there is a possibility of you having more children after this pregnancy, and if you aren't doing something permanent about your fertility, that possibility exists. Planning a VBAC protects your and any future baby's health and well-being. Scar rupture rates vary widely within the population, sharing the same characteristic. And one reason for that is whether labor was induced or augmented with IV oxytocin. That means that avoiding these interventions whenever possible will reduce your risk. What then would it be possible, how would it be possible to avoid the interventions? To begin with, inductions are not just done because medical complications have arisen that necessitate delivery. As we saw above, they are also done for suspected macrosomia, which is big babies, and for reaching pregnancy duration short of 42 weeks. The demarcation point that defines postterm pregnancy, after 42 weeks, you are postterm. The intent of these precautionary inductions is to avert adverse outcomes arising from difficult delivery of a large baby or that may occur even in uncomplicated ongoing pregnancies. However, as we have seen, induction increases, not reduces, the risk of severe adverse outcomes. So precautionary inductions don't accomplish their intended goal. You may wish to consider this if induction is proposed to you for these reasons. The other rationale for precautionary inductions and for augmentating labor is to reduce cesareans. Let's see if they deliver on that. Induction does not. Studies report that induction with a favorable cervix, oh my gosh, there's so much to unpack in this, but I just want to read it today, results in similar repeat cesarean rates compared with labor starting on its own, and induction with an unfavorable cervix, meaning your body is not ready to go into labor, this increases the odds of you having a cesarean delivery. Research also shows that repeat cesareans for progress delay, quote unquote, failure to progress, have largely to do with clinician judgment and could have been avoided. In proof of this, a study found that over half of the repeat cesareans for progress delay or failed induction were done before 6 centimeters dilation, the kickover point from early to active labor, 6 centimeters. Dilation is considered active labor. Before 6 centimeters, slow progress should rarely be an indication for cesarean because progress is often slow in this phase of labor. Another study found that women whose prior C-sections were for progress delay were given 2 to 2.5 hours less time in the VBAC labor than women whose prior cesareans were for reasons unrelated to progress. But they are the very women likely to benefit by being given more time to progress. Well, because some women are in the birth process longer. Some women have a shorter birth. Some have a longer. Furthermore, studies of non-VBAC labors consistently find that women are much more likely to have cesareans when doctors incorrectly believe that baby is too big than when the baby actually weighs 4,000 grams or more, but their doctors didn't suspect it. So the big baby issue is a fairly new thing that's being pushed. It's not uncommon to have a 9-10 pound baby or to have a 6 or 7 pound baby. Every woman, every baby gestates differently. Finally, we have evidence that high VBAC rates can be achieved without augmentation. So augmenting is when you have started labor, started the birth process, and now they are giving you synthetic oxytocin to increase your contractions. Study of freestanding birth centers, so these are birth centers that are independent of hospitals, where augmentation would not be available, reported an 81% VBAC rate in women with no prior vaginal births compared with a range of 61 to 79% in hospital studies. In summary, we have solid evidence that precautionary induction doesn't deliver on reducing cesareans either. And the need to augment labor can be reduced by labor management that promotes progress and by having patience. As for situations where induction or augmentation is indicated, should that become the case, studies document that they can be managed in ways that minimize the risk of overly stressing the scar. Basically, it comes down to my recommendation in the first bullet. If you decide to plan a VBAC, find a care provider who are supportive of VBAC and who are skilled in managing them, and you will have maximized your odds of having an uncomplicated labor that ends in spontaneous vaginal birth. Just an amazing article on this research, giving you the numbers, talking about the risk of the surgery being higher than having a VBAC. For those listening that aren't sure what that means, a VBAC is a vaginal birth after cesarean. So this is women who have had previous cesarean or previous cesareans and are now wanting to have a vaginal birth. So I really encourage you to go to HenciGoyer, HenciGoyer.com, and look at her blog and her research. She has put out several books that are still relevant, but now she's added up-to-date research. So research is important in that often it confirms what we've already known. That's the biggest thing there. So, and VBACs will be definitely a topic of conversations in podcasts to come. Okay, today's herb. I'm going to read a little bit, talk a little bit about red raspberry leaf, because that's usually if women, they don't know any other kind of herbs or nutritional related things, they've often heard of red raspberry leaf. So it can be brewed as a tea or as an infusion. It is best known, most widely used and safest of all the uterine or pregnancy tonic herbs. Most of the benefit is ascribed to regular use of raspberry leaf tea throughout the pregnancy and can be traced to the strengthening power of fragrant or to the nourishing power of the vitamins and minerals found in this plant, especially a rich concentration of vitamin C and vitamin E. It has easy to assimilate calcium and iron. Raspberry leaves also contain vitamin A and B complex and many minerals, including phosphorus and potassium. So anytime you can get a whole food, you should try to get most of your nutrition from foods. But a whole food like red raspberry leaf, which has all your vitamins and minerals in it. The benefits of drinking raspberry leaf before and throughout pregnancy, it can increase fertility in both men and women. It's an excellent fertility herb, especially when combined with red clover. It can prevent miscarriage and hemorrhage. It helps to tone the uterus and helps prevent miscarriage and postpartum hemorrhage from a relapsed or atonic uterus. It helps ease morning sickness. So many women have tried raspberry leaf, gentle relief of nausea and stomach distress throughout the pregnancy. Probably because it has that vitamin A, B, and E, and minerals, all those things in it. It can help reduce pain during labor and after the birth by toning the muscles during the birth process. It helps to eliminate many of the reasons for a painful birth or prolonged recovery. It does not, however, counter the pain of cervical dilation. So this is more about toning the uterus, keeping it as relaxed as possible. It can help postpartum. It encourages the uterus to let go and function without tension. It doesn't strengthen contractions. So some people think it will put them into labor. But it doesn't do that. It does allow the contracting uterus to work more effectively and so may make the birth easier and faster. It may. There's, of course, many other factors involved. It can help bring down an undelivered placenta. Raspberry leaf alone is not effective. It can be combined with ground ivy or angelica. It does facilitate the birth of the placenta, but either of those herbs alone would do. It can assist in producing plentiful amount of breast milk, or as we say, a copious amount. So, and you know it. It's the high mineral content of the raspberry leaf that assists But its astringency may be counter for some women. So again, we just want to pay attention to what our bodies need. Now, I'm sure I should be putting a disclaimer in here in that I am not a doctor, a medical person. I am not a herbalist. I'm just a mother and perinatal specialist sharing some information with you. I trust that you are mature enough to read more on your own and will discern what the best thing for you is. So I'm sure we're all supposed to put this disclaimer of do not use this. It's not intended or implied to substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Not intended to replace your care provider. You're encouraged to confirm any information with whoever you choose, whether that's a naturopath, nutritionist, pediatrician, lactation consultant, family doctor, midwife, whoever you are choosing. So just want to remind you of you being an adult and can do these things. Okay. Well, I hope you enjoyed that rambling bit of show today. Thanks again, Drina, for coming on and sharing a couple of your thoughts on your births. And like I said, if you're interested in joining me, if you would like to share your own story, and maybe you've written a poem or had a song. Oh, if you have written a song, that would be awesome too, about being a mother, about your own birth process, about your experiences. If you have knowledge to share, I'm always looking for anyone who has things to share in the perinatal year from, like I said, naturopaths, herbalists, essential oils, all the things that we love and want to learn more about. So I'm going to end today's show with a poem. This is a poem that I like to share with families at some point during our class, with my clients during meetings, and just remind people, as Robbie Davis Floyd says, that we come from generations of excellence in birth. This one poem is called The Passage, by Marcy Makera. The earth shook. The women gathered. The chanting of the women of a thousand generations began, their hands entwined. I breathed low, moaning deep through my body to touch the depth of sound they generate. And for a moment, I am with them. We're here with you. You are one of us. You can do it. One of them, I breathe. The coals glow, mocking my strength. Embers flick their tongues, tormenting my courage. I step onto the coals. The women of a thousand generations push closer to the embers, their faces glowing from the coals. I keep my eyes on them, focusing on their ability to push through the pain, to keep walking in spite of their fear, remembering that they made it to the other side. I find my courage and step again. I feel the embers and wince. The women start beating a drum. I find their rhythm in my abdomen and slowly move forward. One step, look at the face. Second step, focus on the eyes. Third step, I see the African dancers rehearsing their steps. As I walk my last few, I see the circle being set, the fire at the center, the food and the festivities. This will be the stage for my welcoming into this elite group, this women of a thousand generations. My heart swells. I'm close to the end now, and my body starts to shake, spirit stronger than the flesh. I want to give up, to step on the cool grass and off these coals. I look for the faces, and my eyes meet theirs. One of them smiles. She, who is with woman, reaches out her hand. Her face is the clearest, eyes at my level. Listen to your body and do what it tells you, she says, no trace of concern. The chanting continues. The chanting changes. Listen to your body. In rhythm, hands are again joined like an infinite chain. I realize just how many have gone this way before me. The one who smiled places her hand on the shoulder of the one who is with woman, with me. And I breathe, stretching out my hand to grasp the outstretched. I am about to cross over. Silence comes over the universe. I'm near the end. My body aches. My mind is empty of everything but that last step. Last step. Hands grasp. Cool grass on my toes, cooling my feet. My arms reach out to claim my prize. Reach down and take your baby. I hold him to me tightly and proudly take my place in the chain. I am now a woman of 1,000 generations. The celebrations begin. That was a poem called The Passage by Marcy Marquera. I hope you enjoyed your time with me today. Again, please send me a message if you have questions, if you'd like to anything talked about on the show. You can visit my websites for more information, www.NorthStarPerinatalCenter.ca or www.NurturingExpectations.com. You can find me on Instagram and on Facebook. I'd love to hear from you. Thanks again for being here. I hope the rest of your day is blessed. Go be a blessing. Bye for now.